they're getting wild for me. And all the pretty chicks all wanna smile at me. These rap cats, man, they all got this out for me. And if I ever see them, man, they probably bow to me. And when this beat drop, I know they gon' lean. Word they be.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Amon Sheeran's Pirate Radio Podcast. On today's episode, we're lucky enough to have another illustrious guest, Daniel Nguyen, pro runner for the Brooklyn Track Club. Daniel, thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. All right, so we're going to start out where we always start out with the question, what made you want to start running competitively as a kid?
Oh, that's a good question. I think for sure it was that I wanted to do something competitively as a kid.
Right.
I know that's like the starting point. Like basketball was my first sport, and I want like probably the very first thing I wanted to do with my life was to be a professional basketball player. But my dad is a really good runner. I knew he was good. Like he ran 4:20 in the mile as a junior in high school back in like cinder track days and stuff like that. So wow. I knew there was kind of some talent there. And then he was still running as a master's runner, when I was in high school. He actually set the American age group record in, I think, the 15 and 20K on the roads.
Wow.
for 60 to 64. He has those American records, or at least he did. I think he would have told me if they got broke, so I don't think they did, but they have since then. But so I knew he was a good runner. I like pretty much playing any sport, so it kind of made sense. So definitely from a young age, it made sense. I didn't try to be a runner at all until I started high school. And then I didn't take it seriously until at least my junior year of high school. And then it was like, I want to go to D1 and I want to break 4 in the mile and all those things started, all those ideas started coming in my head.
Gotcha, yeah. So that changed quickly. And you grew up in Oregon, right?
Yeah. From Portland, University of Oregon was Steve Prefontaine and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And all that stuff was just kind of part of the culture, for sure.
So living out there compared to here, is it running like much more prevalent out there? Is everyone a runner?
No. Okay. Not at all. I would say, if anything, and I'm kind of speaking from, like, I haven't spent like serious time out there lately, and I kind of feel like there have been more runners out there lately, especially because now it's like Nike, Adidas, like there's more corporate level like running going on out there than I noticed back in the day. But it was weird to be like a runner. It was still like, you know, like wearing short shorts was I didn't actually wear short shorts like besides for racing until my senior year of high school, because I didn't want it was a bad look and stuff. So it was not like normalized. It wasn't like no one like knew more about running at like lay people. When I went to Eugene, like Eugene is unique. Like random people kind of know a little bit about track in Eugene, but in Portland, it was as anonymous as any, you know, non-running place, at least from my experience.
So it was like anywhere else in the country where the runners are like kind of the outcasts and weirdos.
Yeah. Although my cross-country team was pretty good. We got second in state my junior year. So within my high school, it wasn't weird. Like we had like, it was, you were a normal person to be on the cross-country team. But like, yeah, like in the broader sense of Portland, very not part of the culture.
Yeah, that was not my experience as a track kid in high school. We were very much the weirdos and the outcasts.
Okay,
so, yeah.
But we definitely had some of that going on too, but the football team was garbage, so
that helps.
One year, and kind of shifts things. Yeah.
Right. So, what made you make that decision to start taking it seriously?
Very much. Well, when I joined the team, I did so kind of begrudgingly. I knew I'd kind of be good at it. I almost wanted to play soccer or do other things. But I kind of knew I'd be good at it. Wasn't especially in terms of going pro, like 1948 5K PR my freshman year. But my goal was sub-20. That was just like what I wanted to do, and I did it. But I just loved racing specifically. So everything else, like the workouts, the training, I kind of got through it because I like hanging out with the guys on the team. But like it wasn't like a pleasure necessarily, but I loved racing, loved competing. And so that just kind of led to, you know, just faster times, just literally just trying to beat people. And then started running times where it's like, oh, okay, I'm, you know, like I got sixth in state and cross country as a junior, which was like a surprise for most people. Like I was definitely not supposed to do that in any kind of rankings or whatever. Actually beat my teammate who had been beating me all year, and stuff like that. And so then it was sort of like coach, you know, like college, you know, low level, like, you know, not the one kind of people were starting to like, you know, mention that I could run in college. So the ideas, it kind of came organically. Cause I remember even saying to my teammate that like, I really want to run D1 in college. And he's like, really? Like, are you sure? Cause I was still kind of in that in between world. That was like, I ran a 424 mile, junior year outdoor. So it was not like, it was definitely like you can run in college and you can run in a lot of places, but not like get a scholarship or anything like that.
Right. So do you remember having a big breakout race? You mentioned a few, but what was the race that really put you into that next level?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know what? Okay. So that same junior year cross country season, I just broken 17 for the 5K for the first time, which was like my whole goal going into high school was to break 17. And I'd run like 16:42 or something. And then I kind of had plateaued there for several races. And then we came to this really fast course. My teammate went 15:57 or something like that. And before the race, it was basically a dual meet with the high school my dad coaches, Grant High School, and he had told me, I believe, not like trying to motivate me or anything, but that he thought the top two guys on Grant could beat me, because we were talking about the team scores. Like, my teammate was going to win the race, probably, but then it was a matter of lower down. He's like, he thought both those guys could beat me. I beat both of them. I ran 16:06 for 5K, so just and not like my goal was to like run 16:30, and it just like happened like that. And then it was a fast course, but it proved not to be a fluke when I like won the district meet and got sixth in state. And that was, yeah, that's going from, you know, like sub 17 is great, but a lot of people do it, to like you're actually one of the few guys, you know, in the whole state, you know, winning or placing highly in meets. And that was probably the, if you're going to pinpoint it in one race, between being like, maybe I'll run in college, to like, oh, definitely, like, this is something I'm good at.
Something that's possible. And yeah, that's obviously a huge jump from sub 17 to close to 16. How does Oregon, I guess, is that the right
Oregon.
Way to say Oregon?
Yeah.
Yeah. How does Oregon University come into the picture for you?
So that was, I mean, it was basically, you know, the thought process basically was, I want to go D1, because I always, like, in terms of being competitive, in terms of that being kind of the impetus for my running, it's always like, well, I'd like to be able to compete against the best people I can possibly compete against. They're in D1, so I wanted to be in D1, just for the competition's sake. And then it was like, well, I pretty much want to go to a state school for, like, tuition's sake, basically. and so it was like Oregon State, who they kept on saying they were going to have a men's cross country team and still don't. But I remember like recruiters came and they're like, yeah, we're going to have one in a year. And Oregon. And the problem was I couldn't make the team in Oregon or quite possibly I couldn't. But I went to their like cross country camp the summer before my senior year, and like got to like meet the head distance coach, Andy Powell. He gave me his business card. I won like the 5K kind of time trial that we did at the camp, which certainly didn't prove that I was at the caliber necessarily to make the team, but it at least, you know, at least I won it. So I kind of had like a modicum of interest from him, just enough that he would like put up with my kind of email check-ins. And then that next cross country season, like I kind of gotten out of the thing where I was just racing and beating people and the time was just coming down naturally. And I got like obsessed with those like specific, like, here's how you go to a D1, here's how you get a scholarship times, and I, like, wanted to break 15 in the 5K, and I didn't come close, and I lost the state meet, which I wasn't expecting to do, and so it started to be pretty shaky on whether I had, like, a resume to justify going to Oregon, but it was where I wanted to go, and I just kind of, I almost begged my way on the team, just in that, like, in retrospect, like Andy has said, like, I pretty much recruited him, not the other way around. I just kind of made a point of being like, yeah, like, if you'll let me. And he basically said, like, he likes having in-state guys because, you know, it is the University of Oregon, so it's nice to have those people coming up from the state because obviously they can get recruits from all over the country. And that was, I think, critical in me making the team if I weren't from Oregon. I don't know if just on paper I would have been accepted.
Right. So at least you got your foot in the door and now you're on the team. What was that initial, was it intimidating at all with obviously the history and the prestige of the school?
Yeah. No, it was very intimidating. I had like, I definitely like thought I was going to do well. Like, I just thought, like, for some reason, I believed in my kind of talent. But then it was almost discouraging because it's easy to think that, very luckily qualified for NXN, getting 11th place in my region and then 82nd in the nation. So there's all these, you know, guys that... And you kind of, you're when you're out there, when you're just running a race and you get 82nd, you kind of can feel like, I could have beat like half those guys, just like give me another year, you know, whatever. And you don't really, and you think, like, I'm talented. Like I can see like I'm making progress. And then when you actually train with those guys that were crushing you at NXN and stuff like that, and you started to realize, oh no, they're actually just more talented. It's not like they're ahead of me, like maturation wise or like, It was almost more intimidating when you actually see close up the training of these guys, including like my fellow freshmen, who like I was just like, oh, I'll quickly catch up with, you know, with these guys, and they're like, oh wait, no, this is more talent than I thought high level, high class talent looked like.
Right. Kind of. So that must have been a wake up call. I know some of your teammates were Johnny Gregoric and Colby Alexander. Were they? Yeah. Helpful to train with. Obviously they're in the pro scene now too, so what was it like training with them?
Yeah, those are like two of my favorite guys to train with that I've ever trained with under any circumstance. And then Colby was literally one of the guys that I was thinking of when I'm talking about my teammates who, like, you're like, okay, he ran, you know, like maybe like 4:10 for the mile and I ran 4:16, and that might kind of feel close, like in high school, like I can bridge that gap. Like I don't think he's that much more talented than I am or at all more talented than I am. And then you train with him and it's very discouraging, especially Colby gets in shape in like 2 weeks. So like, even if he has a little injury and you're way ahead of him for like months, you can just like erase that gap like that. And it's very frustrating, just straight up. Like, I'm not even happy for him, just frustrated. and then Johnny transferred his fifth year from Columbia and was like a perfect fit for our culture and our group, and like he and I, especially our senior year, that was like one of my main workout partners because we were just the 1500. Like that was our race, our event. We're kind of similar athletes. He's a little faster and just a little better than I am in a lot of ways, but still similar athletes for sure. And it's kind of similar to some other people too. So.
That's cool. It's nice to have people to push you, get along with, and just have the boys right there next to you, helping you along. What's it like waking up every day to Hayward Field and being able to train there?
That was really special, and not just like in a bullshit way. Like I remember my leaving campus my freshman year to go home for summer break. I remember kind of noticing like what I wasn't missing, or like didn't care about my dorm, like never needed to like think about that again, or lots of things. And like, I remember like the last time I was going to be at Hayward for one last practice before, you know, like whatever, a 3 month hiatus, and be like, I'm going to miss just being here, just like ice bathing outside. Like it was like a kind of special place for me. And it, like like after one of the cross country state meets, which is in Eugene, my head coach had our whole team like sneak onto Hayward at like night and like run a lap on it. So it was something that I kind of, you know, you'd grown up kind of knowing that it was special. It was special to also make it not feel special. The everydayness of it was itself special. So I really appreciate it.
Place. Yeah, it's absolutely breathtaking till this day. And obviously, it's probably the most legendary spot there is in track and field. So I can imagine that's just a really cool experience to look back on. I also had a quick question. The Forest Track, that's probably like a specific name. Do you get to train there at all? Like with the, is that you're near the university?
The Nike track?
Yeah, the Nike track, yeah.
I don't think I've ever really done a workout there because that's in Beaverton, right? Oh, okay. But that is a cool track. What I have instead is about 2 minutes from my apartment right now is the Red Hook track, and it's just the blue collar version of
the Nike track.
Nike track, because instead in the middle, it's all overgrown. It was like a football field where you can still see the goalpost, but it's completely overgrown and dilapidated because it like got closed down because of like it's either lead poisoning in the ground or there was some poisoning going on. And so it's the same situation where it's like all foresty in the middle, but with like a gated fence surrounding it. So I'm very comfortable running on a track where you can't see across.
That's cool.
But far, far more often it was the Red Hook.
Yeah, New York's answer to the Nike track is a little lead, and nothing like a little lead to get you through the workout. Yeah.
Every time I was the first thing I thought of when I saw it, and a lot of people, when they see this Red Hook track, they're like, oh, that reminds me, but in the worst way possible of the Nike.
All right. So, do you have a highlight college race that you look back on fondly?
Yes. I basically paused to not immediately say breaking four in the mile for the first time, but that's gonna be it. I had three goals for myself going into college, which was break four in the mile, become an All-American, and win a team national championship. And so it was about a month after I broke four for the first time where I got to do all three of those things in the same weekend.
Damn.
At NCAA indoors, where I broke four in the prelim, got All-American in the final, and it was the guys in the 3K that I wasn't participating in, but that race, they went 1-2-3, and it did Eric Jenkins, Ed Chesarek, and Will Gohegan. And that clinched the team title for us. So that race that I wasn't participating in is one of my absolute happiest favorite moments. But breaking four for the first time, it was something that I believed I was going to do a lot sooner. It was my fifth year, and I'd lined up for several races before that one where I thought like
this is it.
This could be sub four. And sometimes it wasn't even close. Sometimes it was a 405, a 404, like ugly, ugly races where like halfway in you're knowing it's not going to happen. and so even though I definitely was like better prepared for that than those previous ones, you still kind of had that thing in your head where you're like, well, I've been wrong before. And I really didn't feel very good during, but just kind of like woke up and like, you know, with like 400 to go, I knew it was 400 to go. I knew I could, and there was another runner, Michael Atchew, who had graduated from Stanford, so I was very familiar with him. He was like a 356 at the time, and he was right ahead of me. And I just lit every step of the last 400. I just said, "Beat Atchew, break four. Beat Atchew, break four. Beat Atchew, break four." I did not beat Atchew, but I beat me by 0.01. But it was good enough. Yeah, that was, and even, although, again, in terms of my doubts about whether it was actually going to happen, Christian Serratos won the race by so much, he beat me by over 2 seconds, and he just seemed so far away that optically, even though in the race I thought, at you a break four, when I crossed the line and just seeing a guy so far ahead of you, I told myself, I was like, you probably ran four flat. And I like put my head down on the mat and I just thought to myself, like, it would be like the last indoor meet we were going to run if I didn't qualify for nationals was in 2 weeks. And I kind of thought, as my fifth year and you don't run the mile outdoors, I kind of thought I might only have one more chance. Because after, you know, when it's not post-collegiate, when you're not in the Oregon system and stuff, you, who knows, things can go wrong. And I was like very worried. And then just the tone of the announcer when he said, Serratos went sub four. You could just tell that it was going to be a list. It wasn't just
the one.
Then I started to listen to that and started to get a little optimistic. Yeah.
That's awesome. You're the first ever guest on the podcast who's broken four. We usually ask people who about their first time breaking five. So I'm glad we got someone sub four. How does that compare at all, if at all, to breaking five for the first time?
Five is a really cool barrier. Because Oregon runs the 1500 and the 3K, I didn't really get like the coolest breaking five experience. I did it en route in the 3K.
Okay.
But I remember having not broken five and being very important to me and being like relieved that I'd finally done it. Because that it was that I mean, like, it was fully like, it was basically like the only numbers that mattered to me basically were sub five and then my dad's 420 mile that I wanted to break in high school. And I mean, I wasn't even considering sub four for the longest time, but then obviously ultimately sub four. Sub 17 in the 5K is more, to me, more special than sub five. And I kind of feel like they're slightly comparable. Maybe not quite. I'm not sure. I don't know about the conversion, but sub 17, that was really special. To me, that was a really big one.
That's awesome. So what made you want to decide to turn pro post-collegially?
I mean, it's basically what I went to college for. I would have basically been wrong about myself. I would have felt embarrassed if I hadn't gone pro, which is an insane thing to say as someone who like barely walked on and like shouldn't have been there. But like that was the plan. Like I didn't have like other ideas. Like I majored in political science because it was the thing that I could like be interested in for 5 years while I ran. I had like a midlife crisis one night where I realized that like I was fully like all my eggs in this like running basket in terms of like what I was going to do when I graduated. And in a like an absolute panic, I like signed up for the LSAT and was like, all right, I'll go to law school. People that have been annoyed by my argumentative nature have been telling me that I'd be a good lawyer for years. So I was like, okay, that's something. Like, it just felt like I just needed some kind of, like, in this like manic state. I was like, I was like a 3:48 1500. No, I was a 3:49 1500 runner when I was going through this, going into my fourth year of college. I was like, there's a lot of good evidence to suggest that I will not be a professional athlete, and all I've done for the last, you know, 3+ years is try to do this one thing, and I'm ill prepared for any other path.
There you go. So one of my favorite interviews of yours is after the Long Island Mile, when you ran in the sub elite heat. And you were interviewed by Let's Run. Talk a little bit about that.
I was going to say it's one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. I'm embarrassed by it in some ways. I wanted to do that. That was the year where, I think I say in the interview, I was like kind of wavering on whether I wanted to stick with professional running. Mm-hmm. Like I called it like a professional register year or something like that.
That's exactly, yeah.
Okay. So I was trying to get back in shape, but from a place of very poor fitness. So I was like hoping I had my teammate pace me for sub four in that race, and it did not go well at all. And I think I ran like 4:13. I lost the race. And I was so embarrassed just putting up a performance like that in like sort of a fairly new like Brooklyn track club singlet that I was trying to represent this team well, especially when a lot of people, if you're not, you know, in New York, you don't know who the Brooklyn Track Club is.
Right.
And so I just popped my, as soon as I got off the line, I like pulled my singlet off just in embarrassed, like I was shamed. I didn't want to even like them to associate with it. So then I'm doing this interview shirtless, which I think is like a really silly look for, like, you know, a guy like this washed up pro runner who just ran like one of the slowest miles he's run in years. And I was staying with at the Merver's place because Kyle Merver puts on the race. Right. And the next morning they were talking about the coverage that the meet got, like on Let's Run and stuff. And I was like, is my interview on the front page of Let's Run? And someone's like, yeah, it is.
Oh, wow.
Flat out joking. I thought, because this has happened many times, like I just thought they weren't even going to post the interview. Because I've been interviewed after races and it just doesn't show, or I haven't seen it online. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. Like, I had nothing to say. I'm certainly not the A, you know, storyline or anything. So I was like, I didn't even think it would get posted. And then somehow
front page.
Got traction. Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was a very relatable moment because a lot of people get caught in between and then they have something that pushes them to decide to, going from a hobby jogger to a fully committed pro. So I thought that was really cool.
I'm glad that it resonated or whatever. That's awesome.
Yeah. So talk about your head coach, Steve Finley, and the influence he's had on your training.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So Steve and I met at Oregon. He did his fifth year transfer from Virginia there. He and I got along pretty quickly right away in that we both are extremely competitive and thought we could beat each other at everything. And we actually had this thing going. I don't know whose idea it was. I think it stemmed from me saying, I'm actually pretty good at something. And people like were so annoyed by how I said it I think maybe Steve devised this or somebody did. This thing called the Battle Royale, where we started with some thing that you can compete against one-on-one. It could be chess or Scrabble or bowling or anything like that. And then the loser gets to pick out of all the other available options the next thing, and you just keep track of who's the better person overall. And it was like heated. We took it really seriously. One of my favorite moments of it was we both bowled exactly 85.
That's terrible.
There's so much just like playing it like just psychologically that the bowling was so like went by the wayside. We were just like, it's not an immovable force meets an immovable object. It was like some kind of, you know, both were just puttering out fire or like I don't know, competitive natures and just trying to get in the other person's head and whatever. He was running professionally for the Oregon Track Club for a little while, so we had more than 1 year together in Eugene, but then he moved to the East Coast, and then it took me a few years to move to the East Coast, and then, you know, a few more years to move to New York. We always stayed in touch, and it didn't even totally occur to me to join the Brooklyn Track Club just because I was just stuck in the pro runner bubble.
Right.
So I tried to join at JNY when I moved here. But it was just like, I was walking dogs in the city and they were in Westchester, and it was just like, impossible logistically. And also like, I was not into running. I was trying, basically I was hoping that like guys like Colby and Johnny, who you mentioned, like could re-energize my like love of training at that level. Both those guys were away at like a winter training camp and weren't in the city during like the 2 months that I was on the team. I mean, I liked all the other folks on the team too, but it was funny that I joined and then didn't even get to train with them. But nothing was getting me back. And so I was like, well, I'm still like, even if I'm running 40 miles a week, I'm still like an asset to the Brooklyn Track Club. Like I can still score highly at meets and whatever. And like, all just socially, like, oh, I'll go to the Tuesday track practice and whatever. So I just thought like, I'll just run for Steve's group. And then the fun of it came back, through the Brooklyn Track Club, through the whole culture of it. Like it was just like a fun group, to be a part of. And it just made it so much easier to get excited about that next race and, and excited about training, because it's really hard to train hard if you're not excited about, you know, the near future, you know, things you've got going on.
For sure. We're going to take a quick break. I can only record for 30 minutes at a time, so I'm just going to take a quick pause and I'll come. All right, we're back with Daniel Nguyen. We were just talking about the Brooklyn Track Club, and how it was more of like a startup group and got you remotivated to fall in love with running again. So what's your training like now? Who are you training with, and what are your future plans?
Yeah, so we've started to get like some, like a really good, you know, men's and women's team, but for me, for my purposes, like a really good men's team, with like a bunch of guys that I can, you know, do all sorts of workouts with. And we have our little group text and figure out, cause we've got people training for a lot of different things. So you figure out where you can overlap, and we try to meet up most Tuesdays, at the track for a workout. And we most recently did this, sort of virtual 6 mile race in Central Park where we all met up and you had like a week to do it, but like for to compete against other teams, and we all, you know, got there, did it together. And speaking of, you know, 6 mile races, that's pretty much my training, is like basically trying to be at least 80 miles a week and I've been doing that for a while. I've kind of been, almost like I got really out of shape last summer again. Which is something I keep on digging myself these holes, but I had to really just get, I broke my toe, and it was quarantine. So I wasn't even like, you know, doing stationary biking, or I basically just like, there was no real cross training going on. So I was just out of shape. So I really had to pull myself just aerobically back into some semblance of fitness. I kind of have this mindset about going up in distance. At least that's what I'm telling myself. There's a very good chance I run a track 10K, which is a big jump. So I've only run 3 track 5Ks in my whole life anyway. So, but I always loved Club Cross as like one of my favorite races of the year. And so that was kind of what I wasn't being too optimistic about it happening, but like just in terms of getting excited about something, that's what I trained for. So I was kind of training for a December 10K, and so I'm just trying to kind of be a strength person, but in a way that I like to tell myself we'll just translate into the other events,
right?
Which is basically something I've done before, but I think it'll be important for me to keep it going for a little longer than I have in the past, just basically just figuring myself out as an athlete, in terms of how to peak and how to time phases. And I'm just trying to push that. I always have an embarrassing time, like post USAs, even when I was in my best fitness, like I peak for USAs and then it runs out pretty quick. And I'm right. When pros run the fifth half mile, everyone's like, yeah, I'm just running on fumes. Like, I feel horrible. Like, it's like this mutual thing. And everyone's like way done with their season, mentally burned out, physically burned out. But the other guys still run like 350. I'm like, you know, like holding on for dear life, getting like 18th place in those races. So there's some I just crumble earlier than I'd like to. So I'm hoping that, you know, maybe it makes sense for me to be competitive in the track 10K, but also I think it'll just help down the road in terms of the miling stuff and the spring and summer training, and just kind of keeping my options open in terms of races.
Yeah, that's, I think the two biggest struggles that you mentioned are peaking at the right time and finding the right race. That can be the hardest. True. So yeah.
Yeah.
So just
to interject, mm-hmm. those are two of the things that I thought Andy Powell was most amazing at Oregon. Mm-hmm. Like the way he peaked people, it was like flawless, and different people in very different events, and so I kind of like always like had this like complete trust, and now I'm more on my own for the peaking, and it's not nearly as fun because you really have to get cute with it. And then he would also be so good at getting you in the right race for you to succeed, going in, just to circle back to my sub four.
Right.
I was worried that I wouldn't be in the A heat, and that could be really detrimental, because even if the second heat's supposed to go sub four, you're going to get often like a worse rabbit. The field isn't necessarily, who knows, a lot more things can go wrong. And so I kept on like, I was kind of pestering him the weeks leading up, like, I'm going to be in the A heat, right? Because they don't really announce that until like 2 days before. And he's like, I got you. You're in the A heat. And he goes, do you want, like, what hip number do you want? And I said eight. And I was hip eight, just in terms of how well that day went for me. That was a coincidence. That was not.
Oh, okay.
He's not emailing the UW folk and being like, Daniel needs to be hip eight. He doesn't. But just as a joke, he asked me, and just as a joke, I said eight. And then sure enough, hip number eight.
It's meant to be.
Yeah.
So what are your goals coming up? I know obviously this wasn't an Olympic year, but looking forward to that. Where are you at right now?
Well, I mean, just in terms of like athletically, especially at a fitness level, the Olympic year in 2020 was I was going to be in big trouble for that. And so I definitely needed some time. And what I've been telling myself since, kind of on the same note I was talking about in terms of my training attitude, I have this goal to qualify in four events for the trials, which is another kind of thing where it's like, it's a goal that I think will at least lead me in the right direction toward whatever I need to do. If I don't qualify in four events, I won't be upset.
Right.
But the idea is that I could run times that would get in the 15 5K steeplechase, which I've never raced ever, or even gone over a water pit once, and 10K, which I've also never raced on the track. But just in terms of trying to be kind of ready for everything, just basically just like I know who I am as an athlete at this point, and so I don't think I'm going to win USAs in any event. Just like that's not the goal. So I kind of more really it's like, where can I, like, if I can decide really late what event I can compete in, let me maximize my ability to get top five at USAs or something like that, or even like top three without the Olympic standard would be amazing for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. So that's the mentality right now, and it's coming from that kind of, you know, keep the 10K stuff going longer and keep that stuff in the system so I can do everything, hopefully.
I like that strategy. Have you thought as far ahead as if you do qualify for all events, what would you be your plan going into the trials?
Yeah, I mean, it would literally depend on what the fields look like.
Okay.
I would want to try to do multiple things, hypothetically. One thing, like, I like racing the championships the best. It's just like my favorite thing.
Right.
Like I love running rounds, but also it's the most stressful, worst experience to go through because there is no success. There's only failure in a prelim.
Right.
But I would honestly be kind of sad if like I've already run my last 1500 prelim, because 1500 prelims are basically the coolest, most interesting race in track and field. Like I will regularly watch YouTube videos of just World 2013, semifinal or whatever. And it is an awesome race because it's just black and white. You got to be top five or whatever it is. And the tactics are so interesting. And I love engaging in that kind of thing.
Yeah. There's, especially in trials and prelims, there's a huge amount of strategy that goes into it. Do you think you have an upper hand as a chess player going into these races?
You know, it's an interesting question whether the chess comes into it. The chess, I played in state chess tournaments in elementary school, like K-5 tournaments.
Nice.
And was really bad under pressure, not from a mental standpoint, but like in terms of the pressure, as an elementary kid. And I think that experience massively helped me with rounds and just with running in general, because I went from someone who naturally crumbles under stress to more resilient and more able, like, kind of handle those things. In terms of the mental side of it, I guess I would say no, in that I also think I was pretty tactically sloppy for the longest time. And like literally just had to like, maybe my ability to learn chess and my ability to learn tactics comes from the same place, but chess, I guess, didn't. Well, maybe it's maybe, you know, you get in depth with what it strengthened, but I really had to, like, specifically Centrowitz, who I got to overlap with a little bit, just like fully like studied the way he races, because just the guy, you know, famously most in the right place at the right time,
yeah,
all the time,
so consistent.
Yeah, and other guys too, obviously, like Mac Fleet won NCAAs my third and fourth year, and in two extremely different races, and so just studying those performances, and I feel like it's coming back into style for pro runners to really follow and like watch the sport very closely, because I felt like for a while runners just like they trained and they didn't necessarily like pay attention, they didn't even know, they didn't necessarily watch all the videos and all the races and stuff, and I feel like it's important to put in, yeah, the study and do the work, and that's something like in the world of chess, you know, at least in the professional world of chess, like you have to follow every game. Right. If you're not following games, you're falling behind.
Yeah.
And so I really think it's really worth it for elite runners to very closely follow the way their sport is run. I like to be on the start line, knowing how everyone in the race likes to run, like knowing their style. And I think like I know there's plenty of runners who just kind of do their own thing. It's not something I would suggest, not something that I've ever tried to do. Even like in those like collegiate races where, you know, people aren't famous on the start line with you, I would like Google like my whole like start list in like the fourth heat of the Husky Classic, and kind of try to get a sense of like, oh, this guy is a mid-distance guy, or oh, this guy's a 10K guy coming down, and kind of seeing like what to expect, and just think that's helpful.
Yeah, it sounds like you really do your homework.
Yeah.
And speaking of homework, I really enjoyed the YouTube series Daniel Goes Back to School.
Yeah, thank you so much. I actually, coincidentally, I recorded the 10th episode today.
Oh, nice.
Right before this.
Oh,
yeah.
I just binged it. So I'm looking forward to, I binged it over like the last 2 days. So I'm looking forward to.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So you're a chess guy. You're like a comedy background. And you're also a big movie guy.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was trying to pull them all into one thing, as opposed to weird, satellite hobbies, but I'll say in terms of movies, I still am probably, but I was very just impressionable. Like when I watched a movie, I just wanted to do the thing that was in the movie, whatever. Like I remember The Princess Bride like taking over my life when I was like five, and just wanting to like fight my mom's sticks and fence and all that kind of thing. And it was the Robert Downey Jr. movie Chaplin, which is at best a solid movie, was massively important to me developmentally, because I had to like then make a movie with my friend Ian Stewart, and it had to be like a silent movie, and so I just like, and but that was the one that stuck. Like I didn't keep wanting to, oh, I did, you know, I actually did take a week-long fencing class one summer.
Okay.
So it stuck. The Princess Bride stuck a little bit, but not the way Chaplin stuck, and so that just got me into movies, specifically comedy movies. And when you're into comedy movies, like the stand-up kind of comes with it, because all these people are doing both things, and it's at least movies is a really good interest when you're a professional runner, because it is so much just just downtime, right. And that is like, if you're gonna combine a hobby with pro running, you'd be hard pressed to do better than movies. I guess Colby's a big video game guy. That's in a, there's a lot of, actually there's a lot of big video game guys in pro running. But you know, similar, but something like that is, you have to think,
have a hobby.
Egg, right? Like maybe they are great runners because they were good video, because they were so into video games. Maybe being into movies have made it possible. These folks that like hiking too much, they never had a chance.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned stand up. Is that something you're still doing, hitting the mics around town? Well,
oh man. There were, you know, like there were like Zoom, like open mics, and then now there's like outdoor shows, and I absolutely do not have any interest in participating in those. The act of doing stand-up comedy is like painful to me.
Oh my god! Yeah.
I like writing it. I love watching it. It rarely is a very positive experience, but I think it's like a healthy, good thing for me to do, and I do have that curiosity of like, will this work? Like, and you can't try it out on your friends. Like, it's nice to have this objective, anonymous audience that ultimately is just like other cynical, unsuccessful comedians. So not exactly the perfect metric, but right, something. But I can only, when it gets all the way to like Zoom and like a very like open, anyone can come, anyone can walk by or get up and leave, like broad daylight stand-up show, that's just a bridge too far for me. So basically just Twitter has been the only kind of stand-up. Yeah. for the quarantine.
That's probably for the best. I hear what you're saying about being usually a negative experience. I did a few open mics, and it's like, it's either terrible or getting a laugh is like the best feeling in the world. So
it is, that's the problem, because it is such a good feeling.
Right. Yeah. So it just keeps bringing you back.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So thank you very much again for doing this. I'm going to end with one final question that I ask all my guests. It's a tough one, but if you could have dinner with any dead celebrity or athlete, who would it be and why?
So the first name that comes to my mind, and we were just talking about stand-up, so I guess maybe that's why it comes to my mind, but do you know Dick Gregory at all?
I've heard of him.
He's like an absolute hero of mine, and what people that he was this great stand-up comedian in like the, you know, the 50s, and he was this black stand-up comedian before, you know, a lot of civil rights. He ended up being a great civil rights leader too, but just like absolutely revolutionary stand-up comedian who deserves a lot more credit than he gets for just where stand-up is headed. But also a terrific runner.
Really?
I wish I could remember exactly, but like an 800, 1500 guy, like again, like in this old era, you know, when you know, you whatever time you run then, you could run a lot faster now. And I want to say it was somewhere between like a 410, 415 miler in like the 50s. And I don't think he ever took it very seriously. Like, I think like arguably, like, I bet there's some evidence to say that he's more talented than I am at running and comedy and politics and everything. So he's someone I admire like crazy. So it would be amazing to, like, in terms of, and he would also, you know, one good thing, you know, if you're going to sit down with a dead person is, you know, you might want to sit down with some amazing person, like, I don't know, Tesla for some reason came into my head, but not necessarily going to be a great conversationalist. And with Dick Gregory,
there you go.
You know, it's surefire. So that would be my pick, I think.
All right, that's a great pick. It sounds like he was in that like Lenny Bruce era, someone that revolutionized comedy.
Exactly, like so early, like Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce and him and like not many other folks.
All right. Yeah. All right, cool, man. Thank you. What would you like your outro song to be? You can pick anything.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, man. That's so much pressure.
I know. We asked the big questions here.
I'm trying to think of what will make me come off the best. What do you think would be, like, the best look for it?
I can't answer that.
okay. let's see. Okay.
It's all up to you.
I'm gonna go with this, and I think it's a bad choice. Okay?
Love that.
But one of my favorite songs ever is Another Saturday Night by Sam Cooke.
Okay.
I even have a bad experience showing this to a friend who was like, "That's it? Like, you really like the song? You thought it was like a like a practice version, like a studio version. He thought there was going to be more. So hopefully, I don't know. But that's a song I really like. So I don't know if it's good for outros. I don't know if it makes me look good, but I hope so.
Don't overthink it. I think you made a great choice.
I need to be told that so often.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
I love a Saturday night when I ain't got nobody. I got some money cause I just got free. Now how I wish I had someone to talk to. I'm in an awful way. Take this. I died in town a month ago. I seen a lot of girls since then. If I could meet them, I could get them. But as yet I haven't met them. That's why I'm in the shape I'm in. Here another Saturday night that I ain't got nobody. I got some money cause I just got paid. Now how I wish I had someone to talk to. I'm in an awful way. Now, another fella told me he had a sister who looked just fine. Instead of being my deliverance, she had a strange resemblance to a cat named Frankenstein. Here another Saturday night and I ain't got nobody. I got some money cause I just got paid. Now how I wish I had some shit to talk to. I'm in an awful way. Yeah. It is another weekend. I ain't got nobody. Man, if I was back home, I'd be swinging. Two chicks on my arm. Oh, yeah. Listen to me, huh? It's hard on a fella when he don't know his way around. If I don't find me a honey to help me spend my money, I'm gonna have to blow this down. Here it's another Saturday night and I ain't got nobody. I got some money cause I just got paid. Now how I wish I had some chick to talk to. I'm in an awful. Everybody sing another Saturday night and I ain't got nobody. I got some money cause I just got paid. Now how I wish I had someone to talk to. I'm in an awful. One more time. Another Saturday night and I ain't got nobody. I got some money cause I just got paid. Now how I wish I had someone to talk to. I'm in an awful sound.